episode number 5 of Feedback on Unwind Media. I am Rob Attrell, and every month I sit down with talented Ottawa musicians Damien and BL. Today we'll be covering how trends in music come and go, and why hipster culture is so important to some people. As usual, Damien and BL will be playing some music, which you'll hear sprinkled throughout the episode. This episode of Feedback is brought to you by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download as well as a 30-day free trial by visiting audible.unwindmedia.com. They have over 150,000 titles to choose from, and they have apps for iPhone, Android, as well as tablet devices. So, first up, how you guys doing?
Good.
Pretty good, man.
Good. I'm doing well. The first thing I want to talk about, well, let's just get right into it. You guys have a big show coming up 2 days from when this comes out. It's about a week in advance, but you guys have a big show coming up. What's going on?
Well, we are performing our first wedding reception. So we have taken that leap into becoming a bit of a wedding band as well. And shout out to George and Dina.
Congratulations.
Congrats on your upcoming nuptials.
George!
Yeah, so they approached us and asked us, they've seen us play before, and they asked us if we would be brave enough, I guess, to play a wedding. And it's kind of, like I said, this is a new thing for us. We've played different events before, like Black Tie stuff or fundraisers or things where we try and get the crowd moving, but we're kind of like the background music and that kind of thing. But like with a wedding, I feel like people are ready to party, and so it's kind of like stressful because you want to make sure that you do a good job, that you engage the crowd and that they have a good time. And I mean, a lot of people probably won't remember, but at least they'll be having a good time. And so we've just been learning a lot of songs. What's interesting is that we're actually playing for their special dances. So for their first dance, we're playing a song live for them, for the bride and the father and bride dance. We're doing that for the mother and groom dance. We're doing that. So that's interesting. And that's a little bit of added pressure because those are very special dances and very special songs.
Bet your bottom dollar. Yeah. Everybody's going to have their cameras out for those three dances.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. We don't want to mess up. I actually did not think about that. Everybody's going to record it. Yeah.
All over Facebook too. So there's no messing up.
Anyway, so yeah, it's interesting, and I think the jury's out on whether or not we would do something like this again, just because we felt just a lot of pressure. And George and Dina, if you're listening to this, it's in no way because of what you've said or done. Like, we appreciate it, and we're glad to help out and be a part of such a special day. But I think we're just putting a lot of pressure on ourselves, and with this sort of thing, it hasn't gone entirely as smoothly as we would have hoped, but I think it'll end up being all right. I think it'll be okay.
Yeah, I would chalk it up to just switching gears for us, because for the longest time we were a cover band, and then we decided, okay, we have some artistic, you know, room to grow, and so we would write and perform our own stuff. And then we kind of switched back to doing covers. So that changing gears actually took more time than I think we initially thought, you know. And then you throw in the new, you know, slow dance element into it. I don't think we've ever really played any slow dance songs. So, I mean,
right. There's
that element too that we've never really
We've done some, but but it wasn't like with the purpose of people dancing. Like, we were actually wondering yesterday if people will actually get up and slow dance to our slow songs that we've chosen to play.
Like, we can make people groove.
Yeah.
Like, we make people cry and slow dance and be emotional and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, but it's cool. I mean, I think any wedding that has, for my own personal wedding, whenever that ends up happening, I think I really like the idea of a live band because there's just, and we've mentioned this before, but there's just something so special about having a live band, having live musicians play in front of you that you can like interact with them directly. And it just adds another level of, of memorability, I guess, to the event, because you can, like, I try and interact with the crowd as much as possible. I already, with this, have plans on, like, having the crowd sing along, even having them come up on stage with us, you know, just to keep it fun. So I'm glad to be doing something like this, which is a little bit out of our comfort zone, but I think it'll end up being okay. I think it always ends up being okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Totally agree. It's a lot of fun, a lot of nervousness on our half, because we want to make it good, but yeah, we'll be all right at the end of it.
We're looking forward to it. And so I guess next episode of Feedback, you can ask us how it went.
Yeah. if there is video of the event, we'll be sure to link people to that. Oh,
fantastic. Yeah.
So before we go to the actual meat of the show, I have one more question about this, because I've seen you guys, like, I've seen BL grab a guitar and just start playing at parties, and when people are gathered together, just, it's so much fun, and people, they kind of know what songs you guys know if they know you well. Like, we're talking in a group of friends here, and Damien will just obviously start singing if he hears music being played. He will start singing.
Even without the music, man.
But, well, that's true.
I'm not crazy.
If people come to you in the midst of just playing and ask you to play a song, is that different from being asked to prepare sort of songs you've never played before, maybe songs you don't know, even maybe genres you're not familiar with? Like, when it comes to wedding, a lot of people have an idea of songs that they definitely want at their wedding, and they're going to want you guys, their wedding band, to play them. Has that happened to you guys? Are there songs that...
Yeah, they submitted a list of songs. It was no way... I didn't get the feeling that it was like, you have to play these songs. But it was... well, for the first three dances, the very special dances, those, they picked those. And then they kind of had a separate section where it was like, these are some songs that we would love to hear you play, and it was quite an extensive list, so we kind of picked and chose from that list. And also, I was actually thinking today that it was kind of like when Genius in Apple, like, when you it picks up what songs you like, and then it's like, you also might like this song. So that was the kind of thing that we did too, where it's like, well, okay, maybe that so much isn't like, maybe we couldn't see ourselves like doing that song justice, but maybe we can pick this song, which is kind of like in the same arena as the song that they suggested, so we can still have that same feeling. So yeah. And then we're also planning on, when we're taking breaks during our sets, between our sets, we're planning on playing an iPod as well. And so they also requested songs that they would like to hear on the iPod. Those songs definitely, I think, will be songs that we're going to try and like get people to get up and dance and be on the dance floor. But in terms of like during the gig, just because we spent so much time practicing these songs, we're not a band that usually takes requests unless we already know the song. We don't usually invite people to just come up, because we always seem to have this overarching idea of what the sets are going to be, and there's sort of a plan to it all and a transition from low energy to high energy, or from sitting down to standing up and singing along and stuff. So there's kind of like this whole process through the entire thing. And so if we kind of just like, you know, inject songs in that, it might upset the flow or something that we've tried to work hard to achieve. Okay.
But I mean, if one were to approach me during a party and we're playing along, yeah, sure.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But those are, you were asking two questions. So yeah. To the first question, yeah, of course. I'll play anything.
More pressure to play a song that you maybe don't know very well or just kind of heard and pick up a guitar and start playing it? Or is there more pressure to be asked to play a song at somebody's wedding that maybe you're not familiar with?
Of course there's more pressure at the wedding, because at the party...
But then you have more time to...
It means more, too.
It means more at the wedding. It's less casual.
So it's still more...
I feel like it's still more...
That payoff of that instant success. So if someone came up to me and said, oh, I heard this song on the radio, and I may have heard it once or twice, and they asked me, yes, I have a shorter period of time. But if I nail it, that proves that I have something special there, and I've nailed it in a short period of time, and that gives me a lot of joy,
right,
to be able to kind of figure out my way through a song by myself on the spot, kind of without practice. I think that gives me a lot of joy to be able to do that.
Mm.
Are you guys playing any originals on that show, or is it this just covers? You guys talked about that, or is it just?
We did talk about that very briefly. A lot of our originals. Well, a lot of our originals aren't sort of get up and dance kind of thing things, but we have a couple that people could dance to, but we haven't put them into the set list officially.
Okay.
But if we find that maybe we're running out of songs, or if we find that, you know, someone who might have seen us before asked for an original or asked for a specific song, then maybe we could do that. I did bring up because we did obviously meet with the bride and groom, and they brought up, you know, what kind of music they enjoy, and so folk came up, and we're doing a couple folky songs, but I also mentioned that we have a song that's a little bit folky. If they wanted that, that's a possibility as well, but obviously, I don't think they've ever heard The Storm, so
okay.
So I don't know if they, you know, would even jump at the chance because they don't know what to expect. But yeah, so I think right now we'll just stick with just covers. We'll see how the night goes. I mean, the thing about it is that, yeah, I've mentioned that we're trying to work hard to put this set together, but also for us as a band to just kind of communicate and be like, okay, where are we at right now? Like, maybe it's better to do this song at this time, or, you know, as we get more comfortable throughout the night, as the crowd gets looser throughout sure. the night, maybe we can play around with the set a little bit more. But yeah, so yeah, but right now it's just all covers.
And at the end of the night, as long as the bride and groom are happy with the result, honestly, covers or not, or
most yeah, important true. Thing.
Yeah, most important thing.
Yeah.
Top of mind for sure.
Yeah.
You think they're going to have a happy day regardless. It's you guys are icing on the cake, and everybody loves icing. So, if that helps to take any of the pressure off, which I'm sure it does not.
I think people might be like, oh, cool, there's a band here. Yeah. You know, like people might take a look and be... Because you don't see a lot of wedding bands.
No.
Sorry, obviously you see a lot of wedding bands, but you don't see, like, a lot of the weddings I've gone to didn't have a wedding band. They had, like, a DJ or someone was playing an iPod or something like that. And I think mainly it's because wedding bands are very expensive and you're definitely yeah. paying for what you get. We were not very expensive because, again, we're doing it a lot also for the experience and for fun, as well as contributing to this very special day for them. But, so yeah, I guess icing on the cake, but, and we're not going to do horribly, but if we did horribly, then that would be
like
stale icing on the cake.
least we're icing.
Yeah. At least we're icing.
We're on the cake.
But I honestly think it's going to be fun. I think the songs that we have, I mean, how can you not have fun with them? A lot of songs that we have, people are going to recognize them. People are going to want to sing along. People are going to jump up and down. Hopefully.
Yeah.
Hopefully. I don't want to jinx us, but.
Yeah, yeah, there's a handful of people out there who know who we are, even just in passing. I've got a couple of friends in the crowd there, too.
At the wedding. Yeah,
at the wedding.
You have some people.
Shout out to Darren Mason and Katie, and they'll be there. And Mitch and Alex will likely be there. So we'll have a good handful of people out there that we know.
So there'll be some people dancing regardless.
Well, you guys, I mentioned you on the podcast. You better be dancing.
You gotta be dancing now, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's good. I'll let you guys have your time to prepare your remaining 1 week, and then we'll check back with you next month to see how it went.
Cool.
So on to the first real topic of the show, which I'm just going to call hipsterism in music. We talked briefly before the show about how there's a good kind of hipster and there's a bad kind of hipster, and there's a stereotypical kind of music hipster that like wants to hear the underground bands and goes to shows and doesn't care that, oh, I'm so cool. And then there's the hipster who's really just a, like, likes discovering new music.
Yeah.
And Damien, I think you in particular want to talk about this. So why don't I let you start off the conversation. I think you're a music hipster, so maybe you're in a good position to start.
But I'm like not a pretentious music hipster, though. I think that you're, yeah, I'm the second one that you mentioned. As you were saying that, I actually was thinking about this Kimmel skit that he did, or this segment that Jimmy Kimmel did, where he went to Coachella, I think, and they made up fake band names, like the Regis Philbins or something, and they asked these people, oh, what do you think of the Regis Philbins? Like, and, or are you excited? Like, who are you here for? And they would say, this person, this group. Are you excited to watch the Regis Philbins? And the Regis Philbins don't exist. That's not a band. And
there's a band somewhere called the Regis Philbins.
Now, probably. Yeah. Well, yeah, probably, especially now. But but then a lot of these people were just like, oh, yeah, I'm totally stoked to listen to the Regis Philbins. Oh, tell me, what did you think of their last album? And they just like made up. And it's like, I thought it was really, really good. I think they're coming into their own. What do you like about this band? You know, I just like their whole sound. And like that specific response was like across the board. Yeah. A lot of people were just like something as general as, I just like their whole sound. And I just think that, yeah, that's like the bad kind of hipster, which is like, they just want to be, and this is not just for music, but for everything. Yeah. Like they just, I feel like they just want to be different for the sake of being different. They just want to go against the mainstream. And they find really obscure music, which probably has its value. But I've seen people that as soon as one of their favorite bands gets widely popular, they abandon that band. And it's like, if you really liked them, if you really appreciated them, you would be so happy that they have achieved some form of real success.
Yeah.
But now, because more people know them, you are like, no, I'm not down with them anymore. Like I'm moving on to the next one. And I think a lot of artists are trying to make a name for themselves in their art. I mean, music isn't easy to make a name for yourself in. So, like, I think a lot of artists go into the music industry with the goal of becoming someone notable. And so I think that if you claim that you like an artist and then they become notable and then you abandon said artist, then you're kind of just, like, kicking their dreams in the butt. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know? So that's, I would say that's a more negative stereotype of a hipster. I'm fine with being called a hipster personally when it comes to music. And I also dress a little bit differently as well. So, you know, whatever. Okay, fine. I'm a hipster. but I do it with the sole purpose of, I just like to be, up to date with the new music that's coming out. Being a, and I use this word loosely, musician, being a musician, I like to draw inspiration from other people and see like what other people are doing out there, because it's, music has been around for ever. So,
yeah.
So like, it's very hard to do something different in music. So I want to know who's doing something different. And I've written a lot of songs or came up with concepts for songs by listening to other people's songs, and it's really been helpful for the songwriting process as well. And so I just like to stay up to date with who's big right now, who's up and coming, and all the more power to them if they achieve some really big success from their albums or from their songs. But that's why I do it. I like the little bands, the underdog bands, just because I think they're really interesting and doing something really cool and contributing, and that they need to be appreciated as well.
What do you think, BL?
I think it's important to support these bands that are less known so that their message can get out there. And with a lot of the radio stations picking the top 40s and playing them over and over, I find them a little bit stale. So much like Damien, I find the need to kind of find the individuals that are pushing the boundaries just a little bit. But I wouldn't consider myself too much of a music hipster per se. I like the top 40 stuff. I'd like to bring another element into it too, because hipster music isn't simply discovering your contemporaries that are like unknown. Yeah. What about people from the past that are unknown to other people too? You know, like if you follow this group for a long time and they're from a time long ago and not many people know them, it's, you know, you can be a hipster that way too, you know?
Yeah.
Bring them back, and some people don't know.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know of people who really contributed a lot to music today. Like, and for a lot of people, if you aren't in the music industry, you might not know the immediate effects of that artist. One person comes to mind, like Jeff Buckley, who was really huge in the 90s. Before he passed away. Like,
really? When you say really huge, was it huge? Who was big in the 90s? What, like Backstreet Boys or whatever? Or No Doubt?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He was big in his, like, area.
In his area,
domain.
Yes.
He's huge.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think a lot of people have probably heard his version of Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen, which is, like, a really beautiful version of that song. But he passed away when he was really young. He accidentally drowned, and that was it. Wow. He was gone. I think just with his voice, with his songwriting, with his guitar playing, I think he really contributed to a lot of people now. People might not have heard of Jeff Buckley, or, obviously a lot of people have heard of like Buddy Holly or another person who had a like untimely death, who like directly influenced the Beatles. There are a lot of unsung heroes in music, a lot of people that have done something that, nobody remembers anymore. And it's kind of like, I mean, it's a different sort of scale for, like, we discussed in previous episodes about Paul McCartney, and, like, a lot of people didn't know who Paul McCartney was until he started collaborating with Kanye.
Yeah.
But that for me is, like, crazy. Like, you should teach your children who Paul McCartney is.
At least who the Beatles are.
Yeah. But a lot of people who contributed very much who go unnoticed. And so, yeah, that's another element to it too, is like finding the people that, and for a songwriter as well, like finding the people who have gone before and see, what they did with songwriting. Like James Taylor is like a songwriting king, and like Bob Dylan, obviously, and like Cat Stevens, like these guys really wrote some really awesome songs in the 60s and 70s. That contributed to songwriting now.
Right.
So if you call yourself like a musician, it would be good to go back and see the people who have kind of did a lot of the heavy lifting for the music industry to get to where they are now, to get to where it is now.
Yeah. So I think in that sense too, there's like a third element of kind of knowing where music has come from to how you arrive here, so that as an artist today, you know how to go forward, and then you see what your contemporaries are doing. So that'll give you a fuller picture, you know, of the landscape, from past, present, and into the future, hopefully.
Right. Mm. I think there are a lot of people who get into music and they'll start doing something or start using some corporation, whatever musical thing, and not necessarily know the history of where it came from. And it could come from someone like Buddy Holly, or it could come from someone like, Nirvana with Kurt Cobain. He was, I think was it grunge music that he was sort of a pioneer of, and younger people may not know that's, if they're taking parts of his sound, they may not actually know that it was him. And one of the biggest examples that I've heard of in, I guess, I think it's all genres of music. Have you guys ever heard the Amen Break?
The Amen Break.
It's this 6-second drum loop from a song back in, I think it was the 60s or 70s. It was on a B-side of some unknown record, and it was a drum break in this song that nobody had ever heard of. And then when sampling came around in the 80s, it got found, And there are, I want to say, last time I checked, there are literally thousands of songs that use this drum loop. In some, like, they cut it up and they speed it up and they slow it down and they change the pitch. But if you go look, I'll put a link to the, there's a documentary about it, I believe. It's just a 6 second drum loop that appears in, like, their Lady Gaga's used it. I think they said Bruno Mars has used it. Like, every artist you can name has probably used it in at least one song, and they probably don't even know where it came from.
Yeah.
But it's just crazy. It's the simplest beat too. It's, if you heard it, well, like, I heard it first probably 3 or 4 years ago, and every time I hear a song with that loop in it, in any way, like, it's so distinctive, you're just like, oh, there it is again.
Do you need, like, a fill, like a certain rhythmic pattern that people duplicate, or is it the actual recording that has been duplicated?
I'm sure people have duplicated the actual sound, or replicated it and used it, but there were, when they're talking about sampling, it's literally,
they literally use
the same loop and just clip it up in different ways. But it's so interesting because nobody, that band that did it wasn't famous. I don't even remember their name right now.
But then you get into this whole, the whole legality of doing something like that too, right?
Yeah.
Like, is that band receiving royalties for people using their stuff?
I'm going to say in some cases they probably are, but in the vast majority, I definitely think they aren't.
Yeah.
But is it something as silly as trying to trademark the way your phone is shaped? Like, was it the Apple?
The rounded rectangle, yeah.
So can you own that? Can you own a shape? Can you own a rhythm? Like, if I tapped out something right now on this very table and I copyright, does that make sense to do? Like, it's, shouldn't it be owned by everybody?
True. I don't know.
Yeah. There's a certain point that, and there's, I mean, I get, if your entire song uses it in the background as a drum loop, it's maybe not fair use, but if you use a sample of some recording in your own art, it's fair use, and that's not a violation of copyright. So yeah, it's kind of a gray area.
Yeah.
one of the things, going back to hipsterism itself, it always confused me so much when people would say, "Oh, that band sold out. I used to love them, but now they're just big and they're making crappy music." It doesn't, like, if you were really a fan of them before they were big, you helped propel them to where they were.
And now you're complaining about what you did.
I can't believe that now everyone likes them. I can't like them.
Yeah.
I really don't understand that mentality. If you like them, you like them. Why does it matter that they're big or small?
I think in some cases, people, when they say this band sold out, like, this band shamelessly promoting themselves, or, you know, now they have a brand of cologne, or now they have, you know, all of this, which comes with success. Like, if you, now they have books, like, and movie deals, and now they have
product placement in music videos.
Yeah, for sure. Which I guess in especially for specific types of bands kind of goes against sort of the conventional idea of what whatever their genre is, and whoever their listeners are. Like, if you, like, the first band that came to mind was Metallica, because I know that a lot of people say Metallica sold out. Like, I know that a lot of people say that Metallica isn't about, you know, the music anymore, or, you know, whatever. But I think that, yeah, I don't think that's fair. I mean, everybody's going to make a living, you know? So, but I think that maybe for a lot of it, it's like rock and roll fans, especially, they are kind of like against the man and against the establishment. This is just casting a huge, huge, broad, general
stereotype. Yeah.
But it's a stereotype. But so, like, if you see one of your favorite bands, like, supporting, like, bureaucracy or capitalism, like, you might not enjoy that, because to you that goes against the values and ideals of the music that you enjoy. So I think it's kind of, you got to make sure as the band as well, that what, everything you do as a band, you know, as individuals is one thing, but as a band, as a unit, everything you do should probably align with the values of the band. And it's kind of bad to say, but also align with the image that you've also set up for yourself. If you do too much promoting of other businesses or products, or if you do too much, like if you're oversaturating the market with yourself just to make a quick buck and then get out of there, then that's, you know, then that's not good. That's kind of using your talent for a different purpose. But one band who I think did it kind of the right way was the Black Keys. When they were starting out, nobody was really listening to them. Right. And then I think it was a car commercial or a beer commercial had approached them and they were like, can we use your song? And so they kind of battled with this whole, like, would we be selling out kind of thing? And then, so people were wondering in that beer commercial, what song is that? And then they started Googling the Black Keys, and now the Black Keys is like a huge band. Well, in my eyes.
No, I think they're pretty universally established in North America as being a huge band.
And a lot of it, like what they attribute it to, is putting their songs in commercials. Yeah. that's what helped them to be successful. So I think if you do it in a smart way, then nobody should ever take that away from you.
There's a
success.
There's a recently departed show, The Colbert Report, a few years ago had, what did they call it? It was like a sellout off between the Black Keys and Vampire Weekend.
Oh.
And he had them sitting on opposite sides of his desk, and they basically fought as, and were like playing clips of the commercials that their songs were in, trying to see who was, it was either they were fighting to see who was the biggest sellout or who, like, I don't know. I assume it was who was the biggest star, because they were like going back and forth, like, "Oh, my song is in this product's commercial."
Yeah,
and it's funny how that happens, because it all kind of happens at the same time. You could even hear the same song in two different commercials at the same time. It's crazy how that happens, and it also makes me think. As soon as you said the Black Keys and music video, it made me think of all of the old iPod commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you can go right back and you can think Feist, Phoenix, all these bands, those are the two that come to mind.
Jet.
They all had these songs up here in iPod commercials.
Fratellis as well.
Yeah,
And I mean, we downloaded them, right? Like we bought these songs or we downloaded these songs, and, I think that was really good marketing for both Apple and those bands.
Yeah.
For sure. It helped out. So yeah, it can be done. Anything, like anything, it's good in moderation. But if you overdo it, then maybe you've got your sights on something different at that point. Maybe it's just like shameless self-promotion as opposed to like kind of making yourself, making yourself established in the industry or something.
Yeah. So I think from there we can transition to bands that, I mean, I guess every band kind of starts out as a band that hipsters would like, because no band starts off with this massive following unless it's something like Them Crooked Vultures, where it's like a super group. But again, that they're kind of a hipster group as well. It's like, you gotta be this diehard music fan to get their music. But what do you guys think of bands reinventing themselves? Like, there have been a number of bands that come up and then they'll kind of go away for a little bit and then come back and they're different. Have you guys experienced that, where you really like a band and then they go away and you're kind of sad about it and you want to know when they're going to make new music? When's it going to happen? And then they finally do and it's different and you either don't like it as much or there's just something off about it.
Mm.
Yep, definitely. Linkin Park, No Doubt, Thrice, Mumford & Sons, all of these guys have had their opportunity to re-express themselves artistically. And then I've had mixed feelings with all of them. I think some that I liked, some that I didn't, but ultimately you have to respect the artists for trying to reinvent themselves when they find, you know, their craft needs to take a new direction. Right. So definitely observed, but,
takes a lot of bravery to reinvent yourself.
To take, you know, you have an audience. If you keep, like, I'll use Mumford & Sons as a recent example because they've just started putting out new music that's different from what they've done before. They have this huge audience that they know loves folk music. And for them to disappear for a year or two, I mean, they're still playing concerts, obviously, but to disappear and then come back with a pretty different sound. Damien, you love Mumford & Sons.
I do.
The band.
Yeah.
But you've expressed to me, at least in the past, but when their first new song just...
Yeah, when Believe came out.
It was... I mean, what do you think now? Have you gotten used to it and it's okay now? Or are you still sort of...
Well, I think there's going to be that knee-jerk reaction where you kind of flinch when someone starts... I mean, I think that a lot of people are resistant to change in general. And so when you've kind of put your faith in one particular band and you've come to expect what they sound like, and then they come out with something. In terms of Mumford & Sons, it's quite different than what they sounded like before. And I've just seen all these comments like hashtag bring back the banjo and like that kind of thing. And I'll take Mumford & Sons as a specific example. Like, they were always heading that way, I feel. Because they started out of a mutual love for Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which is a Coen Brothers film. Great film, fantastic music.
Really great soundtrack.
Yeah, mainly folk and like kind of country and kind of gospel, like that kind of thing. And they were at the time, I think they're around our age. So at the time they were probably about 16, 17 when they watched it, and they knew each other from school, and they decided that they would start making that type of music because it really spoke to them at the time. But like individually, they had all enjoyed jazz and blues and hard rock, especially Winston, who usually plays the banjo. He like grew up with like hard rock music. And so I think that I actually just listened to an interview with them, one of the first ones that they've done since their new songs have come out. I listened to it today. And I think they indicated that they were always kind of heading that way. And even on Babel, even their second album, you could hear it even more. Right. That they were doing a lot more synth. They were doing a lot more electric guitar. They were doing, you know, some more drum. Even on their first, like, Dust Bowl Dance is like this huge, like, hard rock song.
Right.
Like halfway through. So I don't know. I don't understand why people are just like this is coming out of nowhere. Like there have been indications about,
because
they were kind of doing this thing, like they were in this phase, and then now they're out of this phase, and now they want to do something that's maybe a little bit truer to themselves and what they've always been like. And I respect them for it. I think that a lot of what's going on, kind of the resistance is because they themselves don't know what they're doing right now as well. Right. Like they're trying out something new, and it might not be the best work that they've ever done, but it at least is just like this first like step towards maybe even better things. They're doing a lot of secret shows right now, pop-up shows that sell out in like 30 seconds. And they're specifically asking people not to like hand in their phones and any recording devices before they go to the show. And this show is probably about 200 to 300 people. And it's because, they don't know what they're doing. And they're doing all these shows to practice in front of people to see what people's reactions are. And also to kind of get this cohesiveness to all the songs, because these songs are really new to them. And where in previous times they played the songs into the ground before they released it to the public. These songs are like brand new, and they have no clue what they're doing. And I think it's just like, I think it's really, really brave, for them to do that. I think an artist needs to reinvent themselves in some way, shape or form, because you need to move with if you started, when your main audience was really young, teen, angsty and stuff, well, that audience is going to grow up and is going to have a little bit more of a different view of the world. And so you should also, if you want to cater to that audience, you could also, there's an option of just like remaining with that whole teen, like the new wave of teen angst that comes through. Or as like, as, because a musician is a person, and so they're going to grow up and they're going to start to see life in different ways too. And they're going to start to explore different sounds as well as they mature. I don't think that, I don't think that it's good to stay stagnant in your style. I think that it's very good to try out new things. You look at Bob Dylan, who went electric in like the 60s, and he lost a lot of fan base because he went a lot electric.
Right.
Much like Mumford & Sons is going electric now. But Bob Dylan is one of the best songwriters that we've ever had. And so what if he went electric? Like, he still made fantastic music, and he went from folk to rock to gospel, back to rock and folk and blues. And like, I'm thinking of Ray Charles as well, who he did country as well as jazz and gospel. And I'm even thinking of Lady Gaga, who seems to reinvent herself like every 2 months or something. Right. With like
she
a different
recently did a jazz album with Tony Bennett.
Yeah, like, yeah, she's
standards. There's also John Mayer, or Continuum, and then
John Mayer. Yeah, fantastic. Mayer, yeah. Fantastic example. Because, and to be honest, John Mayer lost me a little bit, because between Born and Raised and Paradise Valley, it's a little bit too country for me. But it's fine. Like, John Mayer has the right to become a little bit country if that's what he's feeling at that time. But Continuum was fantastic. And I think a lot of people got turned on to John Mayer through Continuum, but he has the right to try different things. I think it's brave. I think it's necessary. And I think that when you first transition, it's going to be a bit awkward for you and for your audience. And then people are just going to settle down and get used to it. Like, anybody, any change, people are going to have like some sort of uproar from. The Beatles are a great example of how to subtly and like fluidly transition into, because you take a look at the Beatles at the beginning of their career and they were just like this bubblegum pop band. You take a look at the Beatles at the end of the career and they're like, you wouldn't, if people didn't know who the Beatles were, they wouldn't be able to like say, yeah, that's definitely the same band.
Yeah.
Like, they sounded so different at the end of their career, but they did it with such grace. And I think they also did it because they didn't care like what people thought, because they also stopped touring like the middle of their career. Like, they just did studio albums so that they could focus on the production value of their,
right,
of their work. And they started doing like music videos and stuff like that. But, I think it can work. Cause I think everybody probably has a favorite song of the Beatles in different eras and iterations of the Beatles. But, I think that you should just like let your favorite artists just try it out. Because you should really like the person for who they are and sort of the ideals that they have or the perspective that they have versus like what they sound like. You know, it's almost like just only liking someone for what they look like.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Looks can change. Things can change.
Looks will change, and people will get older. And so the same way a lot of times genres will, or someone's genre specific to them will shift. And it's part of being an artist, is just going out of your comfort zone and trying different things and interpreting the world differently. So I especially with Mumford & Sons, I think people should kind of stick with them, because Wilder Mind, which is their new album, might not be like the best work that they've done, but then at least it helped to bridge the gap. And now they're going to start to transition to like whatever is coming next. And
maybe you'll like that better.
Maybe you'll like that better. And like, they have to do it at some point.
Right.
If that's where they're headed. So, yeah, it just goes back to just being faithful to, if you really like the artist, you have to at least be of an open mind when they start to try something a little bit new. Just give it a chance. Don't buy into the hype of hashtag bring back the banjo. Like, like maybe Winston doesn't want to play the banjo anymore.
Yeah,
like he's not a banjo player first and foremost anyway. He's an electric guitar player. So, so I think they're headed that way.
Right.
Yeah.
Or they can discover that the original thing that they were doing is a better fit for them, and they'll go back to it. It's the next step. You never know. So I think you just have to be patient.
Because even in Sons of Pluto, we had a period where we were trying out different things. We have four songs that sound quite different from each other.
Yeah.
And then we started to kind of hit our stride with songs that are a little bit more cohesive. Like they're a little bit, but I mean, So even within, we don't even, those songs aren't even enough for like a full album, but even like within all of the songs that we've written, there's some difference there because we're trying out different things and everybody has a different approach in Sons of Pluto and like a different taste in music as well. Yeah. So it, maybe they're just trying it out and that's what being an artist is about.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is kind of a nice transition into the fact that you guys are looking in the next few months, maybe to record an EP. Yes. And we had talked about discussing some of the interesting ways that we've seen musicians release music, trying to get outside of their, like, you guys, like the ultimate hipster band, because you only played so far in Ottawa.
Yeah.
One time
in Kingston for a birthday party. Hello. Yeah.
So a pretty small radius.
Yeah.
So there have been a couple of, I mean, for a very long time since people started being able to record music, people have been coming up with interesting and different ways to spread their music. I mean, starting with touring itself,
right,
going to other places to actually play your music for people that aren't necessarily where you started playing music, like in a garage or something.
Yeah.
So I don't know, in preparation for trying to record music and actually get people to care and want to listen to what you're going through, like Mumford & Sons have put out new music and I have barely listened to it because there's just so much other stuff. Even though I really like Mumford & Sons, I have to dedicate time to it. It takes a big thing to get someone to actually go and listen to the music you're putting out. And so the smaller you are, the harder and harder it is. I mentioned when we were talking about this, how Beyonce dropped, what was it, 17 or 20 songs, all with music videos. It was a complete surprise to everyone. They just showed up on iTunes one morning. And I feel like that must have broken records.
I think it did. Yeah, I think it
for
did.
For like the most album sales in 24 hours, just because nobody's expecting it. There's no buildup. There's no, like there's a pretty established cycle where you have release a single or two before you put out an album, but she just went for it.
And that could work too, because word of mouth is the most effective way of marketing. And so if people are like, what? Beyonce has an album out? Oh my goodness. Did you know Beyonce has a new album out? Like right now, it's just like, and then it spreads.
Yeah.
You know, versus like, okay, yes, Beyonce, we knew that you were having this album but like, there's like this sort of like excitement and people start to like tell each other and then they're really excited about it. And then they'll just like buy up the album. And, that approach was really cool too, because she recorded those songs and recorded a music video for every single one of those songs. A lot of work, because there were a lot of songs on there, and she released it as one complete package. I think that was really, really creative. She did like a lot of the work all at once, and then she set it out on the world and just could like sit back and watch it all unfold. I think that was really cool. A lot of people do a lot of really creative things.
Yeah, like people mix tape, just anything to stand out from the crowd, you know?
Yeah.
But we spoke about, cause I can't find the article now, but I recently read this article of interesting things that bands have done, to release their music, especially now when album sales are decreasing. And I guess 2014, I guess Taylor Swift was the only one who,
It was platinum,
right? And so you have to do something creative for Sons of Pluto, for Sons of Pluto's EP. I don't know how creative we can really get because we don't have a lot of money,
right?
So it's actually just,
on the flip side, forces us to be quite creative because we have no resources.
Exactly. So we would have to come up with something very creative that is also low cost, that would help people to rally behind us and sort of spread our music that way. But, even in the last year or so, I'm thinking about like U2 basically forced everybody to have their music on iTunes. Like nobody agreed to it, and it just showed up.
I'm glad that you mentioned that when we were coming up with this little list of interesting ways albums have been released recently, because there's a huge, I mean, U2 apologized formally, well, informally with a video for allegedly forcing people to have their music on their phones. But the interesting thing about that is that all that they did was talk to Apple, and Apple agreed to give a gift. They agreed to gift the U2 album to everyone. And the way that gifts in iTunes work is that they show up in your account as having been purchased, and there's a setting in iTunes or on your phone or whatever that allows you to automatically download any purchased music, okay, which most people want. That's the right thing you want. But if someone buys something you didn't want for you and then it just shows up and you didn't want it, it's disheartening.
Yeah. But I suppose there should be some form of gratitude. Like, if you are a U2 fan, then you didn't have to pay for the album.
Yeah.
You didn't have to pay for Songs of Innocence. But if you aren't a U2 fan, well, okay, like you can give it a shot.
Yeah.
Or you can just get rid of it.
Yeah.
You can just get rid of it, man. But I think, a lot of people, I don't know if it ended up on my iPod or anything or in my iTunes, but because I don't think I've heard any of the songs from Songs of Innocence.
It depends on your settings in iTunes, and I think it's more common for Apple devices.
Okay.
But it's so weird. Like, imagine if you open your mailbox and there's a package in there, like a little padded bubble wrap package, and you open it up when you get inside and there's a U2 album. Well, like, how mad are you going to be? You're like, oh no, we're in my house now. It's free music.
It absolutely is. And when I first downloaded iTunes, there were about three tracks that I, do you remember this? There were like three tracks that I did not buy when I downloaded iTunes, that it was kind of like three sample tracks from like three up and coming artists, or I haven't actually heard of them since, but iTunes had put in three songs from three different artists just to get my library going.
So, you know what I think that is? I think, because I remember the first time I had a new laptop, I think those are the ones that come in as a default with Windows Media Player.
Yes.
So it's not even iTunes.
Instead of iTunes, you put it in the library. Just,
exactly.
There's a classical one, and there's like a pop one.
That's the computer. That's Windows Media Player. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. So, I mean, but the same sort of thing. Like, I didn't ask for that music, exactly, but it showed up. Yeah. You can definitely delete it. And that's it.
They had to actually set up a special website where you could go and it's basically like, if you push this button, you are like pressing down on this, what do you call it when you press on the thing and then dynamite explodes?
Oh yeah.
The trigger, I guess.
I don't even know what you call that.
Yeah.
But you basically, like, you're nuking this album out of your library. Like,
yeah.
I want nothing to do with you too.
Yeah. Oh man, but
props for them. That's creative.
Yeah,
it is. And a lot of other people have done. I'm thinking, I had mentioned earlier, off the air about Wu-Tang Clan and how they just had one very expensive, very fancy copy of their latest album, and auctioned it or something like that.
Yeah.
And they had this craftsman like construct this special box that it was in, and like of all this. And that seems really crazy because, like, I guess it was so expensive that maybe they got as much as maybe they thought they would from mass, you know, album sales. But that's another thing too that people have done. You know, I remember when a lot of artists kind of do this like pay what you can thing, where you can download the album and you just pay whatever you can. If it's $0, it's $0. If it's $5, if it's $50, you pay whatever you can. And I think that's cool too, because you're giving the consumer the power to say, you know, I think that I can only afford this, or or they're saying like, I think you're only worth this.
Right. You know, I think most people think the first one.
Yeah.
But I think the first example I saw that was in Rainbows by Radiohead.
Oh, okay. Did they do that within Rainbows? Oh yeah, they did. They did. Yeah. I remember that. Cause I don't know how much I paid for In Rainbows. I forget. I think I might've been a student at the time, so not very much, but I think that just with the way that the music industry is going and just like with record sales, I think that you have to be creative. I think I mentioned before, maybe was it, I think it was The Head and the Heart. They got really big in Denver, I think, because they had this EP that they wrapped in denim and then just like gave it out at shows.
Okay.
And that was it. Mm-hmm. They just wrapped their EP in denim and people started listening to it. Something that simple, like you, instead of being in a case, it's wrapped in denim.
Right.
Something that simple can set you apart. And I think a lot of people have got to start doing that because, you know, the old way isn't going so well anymore, you know?
Yeah. A piece of the band like that would be pretty cool, I think. Something that gives them a piece of, you know, what it's like to be, you know, part of a band or something special like that to attract them. And I think I agree with Damien that the environment is forcing a lot of artists to be a little bit more creative, which ends up giving us more interesting products to consume too from a kind of a business perspective.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Something like a lot of artists will, depending on how much you pay, they'll give you like the handwritten, like original lyrics.
Oh yeah.
From their song, which to them, I'm sure doesn't really mean much after they write it.
Yeah.
Like any lyrics that I've written, don't really mean, like I'll give them to anybody. Like,
you know, sure.
So yeah, things like that, you're right. Like a piece of the band in some way.
Or a piece of your experience where you can actually, Alter Bridge, where they were selling the actual concert that you actually attended, like days after the show online.
Oh, wow.
So you can go back and say, okay, I was in, you know, New York on this day and I want to buy that experience back. And we'll ship it to you in a USB stick shaped like the guitars that one of the guys play.
Cool.
Yeah. So
that's really cool. Yeah. That's a really cool idea.
Things like that too.
Also
kind of creative.
Also Kickstarter though. We haven't talked about crowdfunding because that way the audience you're trying to appeal to feels directly responsible for getting that record off the ground. So there's that sense of camaraderie and that sense of like, I did something to contribute to this thing even happening, but also how, you know, it works in such a way that you also get something from it. So for Julian Nunes, which is one of my favorite YouTube stars who now is kind of making a name for herself. She actually, I think depending on how much you paid, she would come to your living room and do a show in front of you and like 50 of your friends in your living room, depending on how much you paid. So I thought that was really, really cool. That was really awesome of her. And then that I think expanded out into, she ended up doing like a living room tour. Like she would just like ask people, like, where do you live and do you want me to come to a show? And then she would set up a tour that way where she just played in people's living rooms as opposed to playing in venues and just these really intimate shows. But that was part of her Kickstarter for one of her albums.